Judges 2, and we'll be considering pretty much this whole section that we read from verse 6 down to verse 6 of chapter 3. So we've already come through Judges 1, which is very much an introduction to the book. We've had a couple of sermons from Paul on this chapter, and just to kind of just refresh our memories and remind ourselves where we're at. The first chapter of Judges is very much a summary of the conquest after Joshua's death. It tells us physically what the Israelites did, the battles that they had, the agreements that they made with the people in the land, and geographically where these battles took place and how they expanded out. Last time particularly we saw this great tension coming in between the can't and the won't. Originally the people came up against these iron chariots and they couldn't drive them out. But then as their resolve weakened, they start not to drive them out. They won't drive them out until the Lord won't drive them out in front of them. We see this change coming through. When we looked at that within our own lives, so often when there's things that we say we can't do, and it's nothing to do with can't at all, it's because we don't want to do it. We say maybe we can't forgive. No, it's that we don't want to forgive. We say perhaps we can't love people enough. No, it's that we don't want to love people enough. There's times when we say, oh, we cannot resist temptation. No, we don't want to resist temptation. We saw something of ourselves in the people of Israel here. But now we come on to this second chapter. And it seems a little bit strange in verse 6 there, comparing it with verse 1 of chapter 1. We've got after the death of Joshua there in chapter 1, verse 1. And here again, chapter 2, verse 6, when Joshua dismissed the people, so he's alive again. We have what is a second introduction to the book of Judges. I listened all the way through to Judges the other day while I was mowing the lawn, and these first two chapters, I got really confused at what was going on, because you have this one introduction and then things happening over again. No, it's a second introduction. It's a second look at an overview at what goes on in these first few years in Israel. And I found it helpful thinking of it like this. I don't know about you, but I'm awful at watching films. I can never watch a film without knowing what's going to happen. So if ever I'm watching something, I'll quickly grab my tablet, look it up, and read a summary of what's going on. I'll read a synopsis. And some of these websites, they have two or three different summaries of a film. One may just kind of tell you all the events in order and tell you exactly what's going to happen. Others will pick up certain themes that go on through the films. And that's what we have here with Judges. We have two different summaries. This first chapter has very much been the what and the where, but now we have the themes. We see more the spiritual picture of what was going on at this same time. We saw the battles that were had and weren't fought in chapter 1. Now we see what was going on in the hearts of the Israelites. So don't be confused about chapter 2. It's not happening after chapter 1. It is just another summary of this period of the Judges. And we see, where are we? From verse 16, and well, really from verse 11, we see this cycle of the Judges coming to the fore again. We're reminded of this cycle, which is then going to carry on through the whole book, of Israel sinning, of Israel being punished and facing hardship as God brings judgment on them, of them calling out, of judges being raised up, of the judges dying, and the whole cycle going back around again. We'll touch a little bit on that this evening. But we see this summary of what's going to go on through the whole book. But yet again, I want us to emphasize what it is that we need to learn from this book of Judges. When I listened to it the other day, I have to say by the time I'd finished mowing the lawns, I was thoroughly depressed, listening to the sin and the wickedness and the unending spiral that goes on through this book. But we're not to look at the people. We're not even to look to the judges. We look to the God of the judges. We are to see what God is doing in this book. We're to remind ourselves of God's faithfulness in the middle of unfaithful people. The only way to get through this book without being depressed is by looking at God and seeing what he does, how he works, and how he remains faithful. There's three things I want us to consider as we pick up the themes in this second chapter this evening. Firstly, a faithless people. Secondly, a faithless witness. And then finally, a faithful God. Excuse me. A faithless people, a faithless witness, but a faithful God. And I really want us to end on that point and to see how God is working as we come to a close this evening. So, a faithless people. We have already seen in chapter 1 the faithless lives of the Israelites. They had not driven out the nations before them. Like I've mentioned already in verse 19 of chapter 1, we're told that they couldn't drive out the inhabitants of the plain. But then by the time we get to verse 27 there in chapter 1, it's not they couldn't, but they wouldn't. Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beersheba. And we have that phrase repeated so many times down through the end of chapter 1. You can kind of fill in the blanks. Blank for the tribe did not drive out the inhabitants of blank. It happens over and over again. But then we see as Israel becomes strong, when Israel had the opportunity to drive them out, then they didn't. Perhaps it was laziness. Perhaps, you know, you can imagine the Israelites. They're there in this new land. It's all ready for them to take possession of. The towns are already built. The vineyards are already planted. You know, they don't have to do all that work themselves. Let's put these people to work. Let's not obliterate them. Let's not destroy them. Let's just put them to work. Perhaps it's not just 21st century Western cultures that find all of this destroying and destruction something hard to stomach. Perhaps for the Israelites as well, they were losing the stomach for the fight. But whatever the reason, when they had the opportunity, they did not drive out the people. They were not faithful to what God had called them to do. They were faithless in what he had asked them to do. And so there, at the beginning of chapter 2, verse 3, the Lord speaks, "So now I say, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall become thorns in your sides, and their gods shall be a snare to you." These people were going to remain. They were going to be a danger, an annoyance, a pain, a hardship, a difficulty, and most importantly, a temptation. You see, that really sets us up for the verses that we have here in chapter 2 to look at this evening. Because we've seen that Israel has been faithless in their actions, but now we see that they are faithless in their hearts. They didn't do what God had commanded them. And here, verse 11, verse 11 of chapter 2, the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. Chapter 1, they're faithless in their actions. They don't carry out the Lord's commands. And now we see they're faithless in their hearts. They're turning away from the Lord. You see, often a heart that doesn't love the Lord shows itself in its actions. A faithless heart can lead to faithless lives. Here we're seeing rather the opposite. That they're not faithful in their lives, and gradually that kind of seeps down into their actions, to their hearts, until their hearts are turned away from the Lord. We see a very worrying picture here in Israel. They're not eradicating sin. They live alongside it, they normalize it, they accept it, they commit it, they follow it. A very dangerous, slippery slope. God had commanded them to eradicate sin from the land. This Baal worship is abhorrent. It involves prostitution. It involves child sacrifice. God wanted it wiped out from the land. But instead of doing that, they leave the people there. Their cultures intermingle. And what was once abhorrent becomes normalized. What once became what they did becomes what we do. And before they know it, the Israelites have been turned away from the Lord and are following the Baals. Is it such an unfamiliar picture, though? Isn't that also the danger for us as Christians in the 21st century in living in a godless society? That we live in a worldly environment and sin that is often and should be abhorrent to us becomes normal. That sin that becomes normal becomes accepted. That sin that once others did, we do. And it can so easily turn our hearts away from the Lord. This slippery slope that the Israelites found themselves on is so easily a slippery slope that we can find ourselves on. They were not faithful in their lives, in their actions. Here we see in chapter 2 that then they are not faithful in their hearts. What is it that we need to be aware of? We don't live in a culture that is falling down and worshipping Baal, but we live in a culture that falls down and worships the individual. We live in a culture where you're not allowed to say that this is the truth, that a plurality, many truths are accepted. We're not called, though, to wage a physical war against nations, but we are called to wage war in our hearts. This is what Jesus said, this very difficult teaching in Matthew 5. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it's better that you lose one of your members than your whole body go into hell. For the Israelites here in Judges, it would have been hard, it would have been unpleasant, it would have been traumatic, going through battle after battle, eradicating these people from the land, destroying them. Perhaps that's why they didn't want to do it, because it was hard, it was difficult. It must have been horrible. But that is what they'd been called to do, to eradicate sin from the land. Why is it, perhaps, that we don't eradicate sin from our lives? Is it because it is equally unpleasant and hard and traumatic and difficult? Is it because we find it easier to keep a little bit of sin in our lives? Because it's easier to give it a foothold than to eradicate it and push it out and destroy it. We like following the lives of others, whether it's in the soaps or on Facebook. We like seeing what everyone else is like. We like looking after number one and pampering ourselves with time and money and gifts. We like being accepted by others and not being harsh in what we say and just, you know, well, you believe that, I believe this. But how long is it before, rather than just viewing the behavior and watching the standards of others, that we're copying them? And rather than just seeing the lives of others on soaps and on Facebook, that we copy their standards and behavior? How soon is it that, rather than just pampering ourselves, we're living for ourselves rather than living for God? How long is it before we become so accepting of others that we've lost our distinctiveness and we no longer say that Christ is the only way? How could he be? That's just too harsh. It is a hard thing to eradicate sin. It is a painful thing. But like these Israelites are called to do, we're to identify it, we're to root it out and remove it. Whatever it takes, Perhaps it means getting rid of a TV. Perhaps it means getting rid of the computer, cancelling accounts, cancelling subscriptions, stopping friendships. Because we know those things are not helpful. Because we know those things are leading us astray. Because we know those things are tempting us. That is what the Israelites had been called to do, to drive out these nations. And they didn't, and their hearts were turned aside. Let us this evening examine our own hearts. You know what sins you like to give a foothold in your life. I know what sins I like to give a foothold to. What sin is too dear to our hearts to remove? What sin is too comfortable and appealing to be able to eradicate it? What sin we like to play with and entertain? Let us take a warning here from the people of Israel, whose hearts were turned aside after the idols. Let's identify the sin, root it out and remove it. Perhaps we need to flee from it, like Joseph did when he was there with Potiphar's wife. And what did he do when sin came? He just ran away. No shame in that. So that we don't end up a faithless people like the Israelites here. That's hard message number one. I'm afraid there's one more coming before we look at our faithful God. And that is the faithless witness. Verse 10 is a very difficult verse here in Judges 2. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work he had done for Israel. This first generation that had lived with Joshua, that have seen the works, that have seen these initial battles in Israel, those elders pass away. A new generation comes that have not lived through those years. But more importantly, it's a generation that we're told here does not know the Lord. It's just good to spend a little bit of time just looking at this word, they did not know the Lord. If we look into chapter 3 and verse 1, this is what we read here. Now, these are the nations that the Lord left to test Israel by them. That is all in Israel who had not experienced all the wars in Canaan. That word there that is translated experienced in chapter 3 verse 1 is the same word that is translated know in chapter 2 verse 10. And I think looking at how Israel acted when they are under the judgment of God, it seems very unlikely that they did not know. They did not have knowledge of God. They knew of him. They would have known what had happened. But rather, I think it's that they did not have an experience of God. All they had was this distant historical knowledge, but with no experience of the living God. You see, within one generation, a living faith that Joshua and the elders and the people at that time had has gone, and what's been left in its place as dry religion and just a knowledge in one generation. And my friends, that is a huge warning to us as a church, for those who are parents this evening, of the dangers of not passing on our faith to another generation. I want to unpack this a little bit and look at three lessons that we can learn. Firstly, the importance of telling the next generation of our faith. The importance of telling the next generation. The Israelites should have known this. If you ever have the time, look back at Deuteronomy 6. That whole chapter there is Moses instructing the people to pass on what they had seen, what they had heard, to the next generation. God knew it would be important because these generations would come who had not seen his mighty acts, who didn't know about the Red Sea, who didn't know about the manna in the desert. And God wanted to make sure that his people still knew about it. How many times do we see in the Old Testament that great events happen, that God meets with his people, and these monuments are set up? Jacob does it a couple of times in his life. Joshua did it in chapter 24 of Joshua. They set up these stones to remind people that followed after, to remind the generations that would follow of what God had done. God knew that these new generations wouldn't learn about him from this ungodly culture they were living in. The children were not going to learn it in the Canaanite schools. It was important that his people passed on their faith, that they told the next generation what God had done. Do we realize how important it is? Do we value the work of the church in the Sunday school? Do we value the work that is done in Habitats? Do we realize our role, our important role? Perhaps you're a parent here. Children are given us from God. We have a great responsibility to tell them of our God. Perhaps you're a grandparent, an uncle, an aunt. Perhaps you're just friends with people who have children. It is vital that we tell young folk about our God, about what a great God he is. But you see, it's not just knowledge that this next generation needed. I've already hinted at the fact, I don't think they were lacking in knowledge. But that is all they had. Perhaps they knew that, yes, God had fed his people with manna. Perhaps they knew that, yes, God had parted the Red Sea. But oh, that was so long ago. How does God act now? How was God dealing with his people now? You see, we have to be careful that when we tell the next generation of our God, we don't just teach them stories. We don't just give them history lessons. But they see that our God is a living God. That our God is a real God. That he's a God who affects our everyday lives. That he's a God who affects our every decision. You see, Moses' instruction in Deuteronomy 6, verse 7 was this. You shall teach them diligently, that's the laws and the knowledge of God to your children. You shall talk to them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise. Our God is not just a God who's confined to church. Our God is not the God of Sundays. Our God is not a God of history. He's the God of now. A God who should be living in our lives. A God who we should be experiencing each day. The God who gets us up in the morning. The God who helps us as we walk. The God who helps us as we go to sleep. That's what Moses said here. Said, tell your children that. Not just these historical events. Not just what I've done in the past. What I am doing now. And are we in danger of just telling our children stories, as amazing, as wonderful as they are, but not telling them of our experience of God now? As a parent, I find this really hard. It's easier just to tell our children these stories. It's hard to expose our lives, to live our lives openly before them and say, you know, this is how God has helped me today. This is how God has pointed out sin and dealt with something wrong in my life today. This is how God helped me get to sleep last night. This is how God helped me when I didn't want to get up this morning. Are we passing on our experience of God to the next generation? Yes, tell them the facts. Yes, tell them the history. Yes, tell them of the message of the power of the cross. But we should also tell them of our experience of God each day. And that's something that we should all do. That's why it's such a privilege to have children within the church. because they're here in a company of God's people. And there are so many of us here who can say, this is what God has done for me today. It is vitally important to tell the next generation. We should tell them of our experience of God. But we need to pray. We need to pray. Because this is not our work, is it? We thought this morning and read that verse from Paul to the Corinthians, didn't we? It's not in eloquence of words, but the power is in the message of the cross. You know, we can faithfully teach all of what is here in this book. We can faithfully tell our children of how God affects our everyday lives. But it takes a work of God to change the hearts. And that is what we should be praying for each day. We should be praying. Pray for parents as they seek to bring up their children in the way of the Lord. Pray for the Sunday school teachers. Pray for your own witness. Pray that God would have mercy on these young souls. That God would have mercy on this next generation. That they would not only know about him, but they would know of him. That they would know their own experience of the living God in their lives. We have a great responsibility, but let us fall on our knees before God and ask him to have mercy. The Israelites were unfaithful. They were unfaithful people. Their hearts were turned aside. They did not witness and pass on their faith to the next generation. But let us finish by looking at a faithful God. Yes, there are hard lessons in this chapter, but what a God we have. And let us encourage ourselves as we look at how God deals in this chapter, at what God does in the midst of all of this unfaithfulness. We see this cycle, as I mentioned, from verse 11 onwards. Excuse me. What is God doing in the midst of this spiral of sin, this continuing cycle of turning away? Well, God is judging. And we see God being faithful in his judgment. We see that God there in verse 14, he hands Israel over to plunderers. He sold them into the hands of his enemies. And then the people turn and cry out to him again. If you're a parent here this evening, you'll know that disciplining children is never easy. That it hurts. That it's painful for them and for you as a parent as well. There are times as a teacher at the end of the day that I sometimes have to speak to parents about things that their children may have done wrong during the day and incidents that may have occurred. And I know that most parents will be very upset, that they may well be quite angry with their children, and that some form of punishment, whatever that may be, will probably follow at home as they seek to instruct and teach their children. That is how good parents behave. I worry when I have those conversations and I see parents who don't care, who just justify what their children do and then don't follow anything up and don't bring in any sort of discipline. A good parent seeks to instruct, seeks to teach, seeks to discipline their child, to bring their behavior into line. And here we see God's faithfulness in bringing judgment on his people. He doesn't leave them in the middle of their sin. He doesn't just hand them over to the Canaanites, to the Baals, and just turn his back. He sends this judgment. He disciplines his people. So that the hardship, the difficulties, the trials come and they call out to him when they are in terrible distress. God is faithful in bringing judgment. But we also see time and time again that God is faithful in his salvation. He brings judgment faithfully. The people cry out. And then faithfully, time and time again, he provides these judges. He provides a way of salvation. So that whenever those judges are raised up, there is salvation for the people. They deliver them out of the hands of their enemies. They have peace for a time. They're saved from their oppressors. Repeatedly, God faithfully brings his judgment. Repeatedly, God brings his salvation. You see what a picture that is of our need for Christ. These judges, as good as they were, we're told there in verse 19, are we, as soon as the judges died, the people turned their backs and were more corrupt than before. There's not a lasting salvation here. This needs something greater. This is already pointing towards the cross. The cross that with its power, the death of Christ that will bring redemption, that will bring sanctification. So this turning back and corruption that's setting in will change. These judges weren't enough, but God in his mercy provided them at that time. God was faithful in his salvation. But also we see God being faithful in his sovereignty. We have, as we began reading the beginning of chapter 3, this seems peculiar, doesn't it? We've had chapters 1 and 2. We've had God letting his people know his displeasure that they haven't driven out these nations. At first they couldn't, and then they wouldn't, and then God leaves them there to be a thorn in their side. But now here we see God using those nations for Israel's good. That these nations were then going to be used to test Israel and teach them war. How good is our God? He takes this situation that is here because of Israel's sin, and he uses it for their good. You see, our sin never thwarts God. God is his plans are never derailed because of our sin. We see it time and time again in Scripture. We see Joseph's brothers throwing him in that pit, and God uses it for good. We see Pharaoh's edict going out to kill all of those children, and God uses it for good to bring Moses into the palace. We see Samson's lust in this book of Judges that God overrules and uses for good. It never justifies sin. It's not an excuse for sin. But how good is our God that he even takes these sinful situations and turns them round for our good? How faithful is our God? A God who brings judgment and discipline time and time again, even though his people are on this unending spiral. A God who brings salvation time and time again, even though the people turn their backs on him. A God who is sovereign, who turns even the worst of situations and uses them for the good of his people. This is our God. This is why it's worth looking at this book of Judges. Yes, there are hard lessons. Yes, we need to look to our hearts and see where we need to eradicate sin, where we need to drive it out. Yes, we need to consider how we're passing on this wonderful message to the next generation. But let us remember how faithful our God is. This is the God of the judges. This is our God. May the glory and the praise go to him. Amen.